Session number 24197, room 5.
This is the third reel of a taped interview with Ron Allen in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 11th of the 10th, 2002, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Ron, we've been speaking earlier on about when you'd become known as the Rats. Obviously, William Joyce, Lord Haw-Haw, and his comments. What were some of the other comments that he would broadcast to you?
Well, we didn't hear very many broadcasts because when we're in the front line, of course, you haven't got that opportunity. But we did get a circular sent to each post with the latest war news, what was going on, and we would have got the information through that, I think, that Lord Haw-Haw had been calling us the Rats of Tobruk.
You mentioned earlier on Colonel Lloyd, Lieutenant Colonel Lloyd, and you mentioned him coming to speak to the troops. Could you give us an idea of his character, the sort of person that he was, and the way he influenced his troops?
Well, I think he influenced his troops probably firstly through the company commanders and the officers, and then the only time he would speak to the whole battalion would be if they were on a parade. He was well known as One Bottle Jack because coming over on the ship, he decreed that nobody would be able to buy more than one bottle at a time per day. And they soon called him One Bottle Jack for that reason, which I think he appreciated. And even his wife after the war, when she was talking to some of the men that had returned at a reunion, she said she was Mrs. One Bottle Jack, which we realised then, of course, that he appreciated the name. Of course, also it would keep the fact that he was keeping us on one bottle per day of beer, and every time we talked about him, we'd realise that he was still One Bottle Jack.
What about thoughts of other commanders, people like Morsehead?
Well, we knew that Morsehead was in charge in Tobruk, the whole defence. But we wouldn't see him, of course. We didn't see him at all. And if there was any advice given to the battalions, that would be passed on through that daily note that we'd get.
Obviously, another chap you wouldn't have seen necessarily, certainly up until this point, would have been Churchill. What was the general thought that the average Australian soldier had towards someone like Churchill?
Well, I think they thought that he was doing a very good job as Prime Minister of UK, and that he was a bloke that had plenty of guts and was prepared to stand up to the Germans and Hitler and all his crowd. I think they admired him.
In relation to other areas of conflict, obviously May 41, You have Germans invading Crete from the air, and then obviously the evacuation of Crete in June. Yeah. What was the general feeling in relation to hearing the sort of lack of success of that region?
Well, we were we realised that the Germans had attacked it mainly from the air, and it would have been very difficult for the 6th Division, Australian Division that was there, to counteract that, because they probably didn't have any air support, or very little, and although I spoke to some of them later on, the ones that had got back to Palestine, and they said that they were able to knock down quite a few of the Germans that were coming down by parachute. They were good targets. However, they must have overwhelmed the whole thing by a good attack. And coming from the air would be a bit of surprise to the troops, I should say.
In what way do you think that situation affected troops such as yourselves in Tobruk? Possibility that you might, for instance, be invaded by the air, or that the war wasn't going so fantastically?
Well, we were mainly concerned with the day-to-day activities and the patrolling at night, and there was a certain determination, I think, that we would be doing our best whatever happened. When they did break through and make and form the salient into the towards Tobruk, the troops performed very well. The Australian troops performed very well and made it very difficult. But once you get up against tanks and a superior force, it's very hard to come out on top. However, I think the Germans realised that they'd have a job if they wanted to take the whole defence of Tobruk. That was my impression, anyhow.
In relation to the fact that the lack of success of the Greece campaign and the evacuation of Crete. Mm. Obviously, Churchill had hoped that was the soft underbelly of Europe.
Yeah.
Did that sort of deter from your confidence of the leadership of higher command?
No, it didn't. We realised that the German troops are very efficient, and we found this out, of course, when we got at Alamein later on. But I think we can say that we certainly weren't too concerned about what might happen.
Did you know of ideas for actions like brevity and battle axe in May and June in relation to your position, in relation to Tobruk and breaking out?
You mean from the front, from the Egyptian border?
I understand that there was the two actions, brevity, the idea, attack the Germans and Italians, and Hellfire and Solemn and Caputza, and incorporate the sort of breakout of troops as well.
Yes.
Did you know about?
We heard about it afterwards, and we were rather disappointed that they were unable to get as far as Tobruk and relieve us. However, I think it indicated to us that at least they were trying to do something about pushing them back.
In relation to, I mean, this was an unsuccessful experience, obviously, but in relation to the situation of Tobruk. People call it the first major reverse on land for the Germans. How did that make you feel at the time, do you think?
Well, we didn't even think about that, really. All we knew was that we were quite prepared to defend Tobruk. And when we heard later on that it had fallen, we were very, very disappointed, because we thought that it shouldn't have fallen with the defences we had. However, if they used similar ideas they used in Crete, because Crete wouldn't have been very far off the underbelly of Europe, for them to bring troops like that, but I think Tobruk would be a different thing altogether. We weren't at all concerned about that. We listened to the news, and we read the news in our paper, and just hoped that eventually they would push them back and relieve us.
Well, we'll talk about that as that comes up. In relation to the troops that you were fighting, how close were they generally to your frontline positions?
Well, in the salient, they were quite close. It was almost like First World War. But in the rest of the defences, they were probably at least a mile or so away.
In those close positions, were you able to communicate with them, or...?
I have heard of that happening. I think somebody had a musical instrument or something and played a tune which was appreciated by the enemy.
I think I may have heard that they played Lily Marlene or something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
I get the impression there was this sort of understanding between frontline troops in relation to their position, particularly German troops with the Allies. To what degree would you agree with that?
I think there could be. There's two separate crowds with the same idea of and under the same circumstances. So I think that could happen, but not in my experience.
What of the general attitude that people held towards Rommel?
Rommel himself? Well, I think they felt he was a very efficient general, because he had pushed us right back and down, right down to the Egyptian front. But the lines of communication, once they get very long, it becomes very difficult. And that's probably one of the reasons he would have liked to have taken Tobruk, because it would have had a good harbour and it would have provided him with ships bringing in supplies. So it was important for us to hold on to it.
And obviously his nickname, the Desert Fox.
Oh,
did that stick with you?
Well, I don't think we heard that at the time. Mm. That was given to them later on, probably a media thing. The Desert Fox, yeah. I don't think he was that cunning. He'd be like a fox.
There you were, the rats of Tobruk, and he was the fox.
The fox chasing the rats. As I say, it'd be the media on both sides, really.
obviously, you were to stay for some time beyond June, after the failure of Brevity and Battle Axe. How did the situation change for you?
We just carried on. Normally, we'd spend some time in the front line, some spent time in the salient area, and then we'd come back and have a rest, or go into our, what they called a rest camp, but it wasn't much of a rest camp because it was usually round about where the artillery were, and they were being bombed and also shelled, counter battery fire all the time. So all it did relieve us from really would be the night patrolling, which meant that most of us had to sleep during the day to catch up.
It was noisier actually in the rest camp than it was on the front line.
Well, some places it was noisy. Some of them were all right. One time we were in a wadi that ran down to the ocean. And it wasn't long before the boys were going down there catching fish using hand grenades.
Those times down on the ocean, you mentioned earlier on that you'd take swims, and obviously quite a nice rest area for you being a soldier, I suppose.
Yes. Well, we weren't right down on the ocean, but they would take us down by truck for a swim, and a bit of relief like that. But one time we got in the middle of a bombing raid, and everyone had to pile out of the truck. I was on the outside or the end of the truck, and as soon as I put my foot on the board to jump over and get to the bottom, I got pushed from behind. I fell flat on my face. But luckily I had my helmet on, and that protected me a bit.
There you are, swimming in the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
While the war was going on, what was the feeling sort of being, obviously, swimming in this exotic ocean?
Well, we're all swimming in the nude, and one place we were swimming, I remember the planes dive-bombing Tobruk were just pulling out and coming up, and they did machine gun us a few times. But when we could see them coming over, we would all dive under the water.
Doesn't sound like cricket to me.
No, not fair.
What sorts of discussions helped you sort of pass the time in relation to your time in Tobruk? What were the main topics of discussion amongst yourselves?
Well, the war itself. We'd also discuss, you know, what would happen after the war. Mainly about the rations and the food we were getting and the position we were in.
The food you were not getting, or?
What the type of food we were getting. Mainly bully beef. And we'd have one hot meal a day, but it'd be mainly bully beef and onions mixed in it, but towards the end the smell of it used to put me off. Wasn't very good. Then we had tins of mixed vegetables, and we used to make porridge out of the army biscuits, grind them up and make a sort of porridge out of it.
What about news from home? Did that come regularly?
That came fairly regularly in letters from home, yes. probably once a week or once a fortnight we'd get letters. It was quite good.
What about you writing letters home? Were you able to write much?
Yes, we were given the opportunity to send letters. All the letters had to be checked by the officers, of course, as to what you were saying. And if there was anything that they considered to be of use to the enemy, that would be cut out. But mainly our letters were sent whole and they were quite good.
Presumably you couldn't tell anyone where you were.
We didn't attempt to do that, but everybody back here knew where we were.
I understand people used to use codes and things like that to give an idea of what was going on and the conditions and that sort of thing.
Yes, I suppose that some of them could have done that.
Mm. Was it difficult to think of home? Was it something that you actually tried not to do?
No. No, it didn't worry me. I realised that they, you know, that they were worried about us, but the best thing to do was to send plenty of letters back. I think that was to let them know that we were reasonably healthy and not enjoying ourselves, but well and truly doing our job. There was an envelope that they gave us called the green envelope, I think it was. It had green printing on it, which you could send without it being opened by and checked by the officers. Every now and again they'd give us those. But they relied on us not to pass any vital information back.
In relation to your situation, obviously the longer you were there, presumably your health was beginning to deteriorate. What were the main health problems that you were beginning to suffer, do you think?
Well, any little cut or wound you receive from just normal activities were very hard to heal up. We call them wog sores, because you couldn't really get them to heal up. I still had one on my leg about a month after we got out of Tobruk. It just wouldn't heal, because obviously the diet we'd been on was not good enough to maintain the first-class health that we were used to. I remember getting that. It was a wound on the leg that I got when we were out on an outpost and at night, and the enemy opened fire on us, and I dived the wrong way into a heap of barbed wire. That's how I got that sore.
Extensive use of barbed wire, I presume, in a place like Tobruk?
Yes. I think that night we'd been sent out to an outpost, which was probably a few hundred yards from the front line, in a position where it was they could keep an eye on what was happening, and we were sent out to put concertina barbed wire around the post to give them some protection in case they were attacked.
Other health problems generally deteriorating as you stayed there longer?
Not as far as I was concerned, but I think that was the main trouble, not being able to heal up any breakage of the skin that you'd get. I think some of them were affected a bit by the dust. There's always a dust storm, or quite often there's a dust storm blowing. I can remember them, a dust storm blowing from an off-land breeze, then it would go out to sea, and then the sea breeze would come in and blow it back in again. So you got a double dose of it. So there wasn't much you could do when there's a dust storm on. That's the only time we ever wore the respirator, the gas respirator, as part of our uniform in case of a gas attack. But it was very handy to keep the dust out.
Presumably dust storms also prevented attack or deterred offensive action from both sides.
I don't think anyone could move at all once there was a dust storm on. Because the dust was as fine as talcum powder. And where vehicles had been moving and people had been walking about, it would break the surface and the dust would blow very easily.
The longer you stayed, and you mentioned that the morale had been pretty high, I would assume the morale started to deteriorate.
I think it did to a certain extent. I mean, all the boys were feeling the effects of being in a routine of front line and patrols at night when there'd be a contact occasionally with the enemy. And of course the fact that there was always the possibility that there'd be another breakthrough and you never knew where it would come. One of the things that I always thought about was, are we going to be sent again to the salient where the Germans had broken through, because it was more very close fighting there.
In relation to your stay, obviously, nerves becoming frayed? Were there people that you witnessed that just weren't coping with it?
No, not really. No, I think the longer they were there, the tighter knit they became. There'd be quite a bit of consideration given by the officers and that sort of thing, as far as the troops were concerned, to give them the best possible food that they could get hold of, and to make sure that they were on the job and alert all the time. I remember one company commander, when we first got in there, he sneaked up on us one night on the rear of the post and then went crook because we didn't challenge him. So the next day we put a tripwire all around, especially in the part where we knew he could go. And a night or so later, and he came and bang, he fell over the tripwire and he went crook again. So we told him that, well, we're just trying to protect our post.